The Dialogue of St. Catherine of Siena, Introduction, Part 2, by Algar Thorold. Much might be said of the action of Catherine on her generation. Few individuals, perhaps, have ever led so active a life, or have succeeded in leaving so remarkable an imprint of their personality on the events of their time. Catherine the Peacemaker reconciles warring factions of her native city, and heals an international feud between Florence and the Holy See. Catherine the Consoler pours the balm of her gentle spirit into the lacerated souls of the suffering wherever she finds them, in the condemned cell or in the hospital ward. She is one of the most voluminous of letter writers, keeping up a constant correspondence with a band of disciples, male and female, all over Italy. And last but not least, with the distant Pope at Avignon. Her lot was cast on evil days for the Church and the Peninsula. The Trecento, the apogee of the Middle Ages, was over. Francis and Dominic had come and gone, and though Franciscans and Dominicans remained and numbered saints among their ranks, still the first fervor of the original inspiration was a brightness that had fled. The moral state of the secular clergy was, according to Catherine herself, too often one of the deepest degradation. While in the absence of the pontiff, the states of the church were governed by papal legates, mostly men of blood and lust, who ground the starving people under their heel. Assuredly, it was not from Christian bishops who would have disgraced Islam that their subjects could learn the path of peace. The Pope's residence at Avignon, the Babylonish captivity, as it was called, may have seemed, at the time when his departure from Rome was resolved upon, a wise measure of temporary retreat before the anarchy which was raging round the city of St. Peter. But not many years passed before it became evident that Philip the Fair, the astute adviser to whose counsel, and possibly more than counsel, Clement had submitted in leaving Rome, was the only one who profited by the exile of the Pope. Whatever the truth may be about the details of Clement's election, so far as his subservience to the French king went, he might have remained Archbishop of Bordeaux to the end of his days. He accepted for his relations costly presents from Philip. He placed the papal authority at his service in the high, gravely suspicious matter of the suppression of the Templars. Gradually, the Holy See in exile lost its ecumenical character and became more and more the vassal of the French crown. Such a decline in its position could not fail to affect even its doctrinal prestige. It was well enough in theory to apply to the situation such maxims as Ubi Petrus, Ibi Ecclesia, or as the Avignonese doctors paraphrased it, Ubi Papa, Ibi Roma. But in practice, Christendom grew shy of a French pope living under the eye and power of the French king. The Romans, who had always treated the pope badly, were furious when at last they had driven him away, and gratified their spite by insulting their exiled rulers. Nothing could exceed their contempt for the popes of Avignon, who, as a matter of fact, though weak and compliant, were in their personal characters worthy ecclesiastics. They gave no credit to John the 22nd for his genuine zeal in the cause of learning, or the energy with which he restored ecclesiastical studies in the Western schools. For Benedict the 12th, a retiring and abstemious student, they invented the phrase Bibere papaliter, to drink like the Pope. Clement the VI they called poco religioso, forgetting his noble charity at the time of the plague, and also the fact that Rome herself had produced not a few popes whose lives furnished a singular commentary on the ethics of the gospel. The real danger ahead to Christendom was the possibility of an Italian anti-pope who should fortify his position by recourse to the heretical elements scattered through the peninsula. Those elements were grave and numerous. The Fraticelli, or spiritual Franciscans, although crushed for the time by the iron hand of Pope Boniface, rather flourished than otherwise under persecution. These dangerous heretics had inherited a garbled version of the mysticism of Joachim of Flora, which constituted a doctrine perhaps more radically revolutionary than that of any heretics before or since. It amounted to belief in a new revelation of the Spirit, which was to supersede the dispensation of the Son, as that had taken the place of the dispensation of the Father, according to the eternal gospel of Gerard of San Domino, who had derived it, not without much adroit manipulation, from the writings of Abbot Joachim. The Roman Church was on the eve of destruction, and it was the duty of the spirituali, the saints who had received the new dispensation, to fly from the contamination of her communion. An antipope who should have rallied to his allegiance these elements of schism would have been a dangerous rival to a French pope residing in distant Avignon, however legitimate his title. Nor was there wanting, outside Italy, matter for grave anxiety. Germs of heresy were fermenting north of the Alps. The preaching of Wycliffe, the semi-Islamism of the Hungarian Beghards, the theism of the Paterini of Dalmatia, the erotic mysticism of the Adamites of Paris, indicated a widespread anarchy in the minds of Christians. Moreover, the spiritual difficulties of the Pope were complicated by his temporal preoccupations. For good or ill, it had come to be essential to the action of the Holy See that the successor of the penniless fisherman should have his place among the princes of the earth. The papal monarchy had come about, as most things come about in this world, by what seems to have been the inevitable force of circumstances. The decay of the imperial power in Italy, due to the practical abandonment of the Western Empire, for the ruler of Constantinople lived at too great a distance to be an effective emperor of the West, had resulted in a natural increase of secular importance to the See of Rome, to the genius of Pope Gregory I, one of the few men whom their fellows have named both saint and great, was due the development of the political situation thus created in Italy. Chief and greatest of bishops in his day was St. Gregory the Great. Seldom, if ever, has the papal dignity been sustained with such lofty enthusiasm, such sagacious political insight. Himself a Roman of Rome, Romano di Roma, as those who possess that privilege still call themselves today, the instinct of government was his by hereditary right. He had the defects as well as the qualities of the statesman. His theological writings, which are voluminous and verbose, are marked rather by a sort of canonized common sense than by exalted flights of spirituality. His missionary enterprise was characterized by a shrewd and gracious condescension to the limitations of human nature. Thus he counsels St. Augustine, who had consulted him as to the best means of extirpating the pagan customs of our English forefathers, to deal gently with these ancient survivals. He ruled that the celebrations of the festivals of the saints should, if possible, be held at the times and places at which the people had been in the habit of meeting together to worship the gods. They would thus come to associate the new religion with their traditional merrymakings, and their conversion would be gradually, and as it were, unconsciously, effected. It was a kindly and statesmanlike thought. In this way, Gregory may truly be looked upon as the founder of popular Catholicism, that pensive use and wont religion, not assuredly in the entirety of its details Christian, but at least profoundly Catholic, as weaving together in the web of its own secular experience of man so large a proportion of the many-colored threads that have at any time attached his hopes and fears to the mysterious unknown which surrounds him. No miracle is needed to explain the political ascendancy which such a man inevitably came to acquire in an Italy deserted by the empire, and but for him and the organization which depended on him, at the mercy of the invading Lombard. More and more, people came to look on the Pope as their temporal ruler, no less than as their spiritual father. In many cases, indeed, his was the only government they knew. Kings and nobles had conferred much property on the Roman Church. By the end of the 6th century, the Bishop of Rome held, by the right of such donations to his see, large tracts of country, not only in Italy, but also in Sicily, Corsica, Gaul, and even Asia and Africa. Gregory successfully defended his Italian property against the invaders, and came to the relief of the starving population with corn from Sicily and Africa, thus laying deep in the hearts of the people the foundations of the secular power of the papacy. It would be an unnecessary digression from our subject to work out in detail the stages by which the Pope came to take his place first as the Italian vicar of the distant emperor, and at length, as the result of astute statecraft and the necessities of the case, among the princes of Europe as their chief and arbiter. So much as has been said was, however, necessary for the comprehension of the task with which Catherine measured, for the time, successfully, her strength. It was given to the Popolana of Siena by the effect of her eloquence in persuading the wavering will of the Pope to return to his see, to bring about what was, for the moment, the only possible solution of that Roman question, which, hanging perpetually round the skirts of the Bride of Christ, seems at every step to impede her victorious advance. End of part 2 of the introduction.